Good morning, everyone. The March 23rd meeting of Education Policy Reform will now come to order. Welcome, everyone, and today we will debate House File 3504, a bill about parental choice. And we typically refer to it as access grants for students. And with that, we'll give our attention to the author, Representative Mark Biskins. Would you like to move your bill, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I would recommend that House File 3504 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Education Finance.
Representative Biskins recommends that 3504 pass and be re-referred to the Committee on K-12 Finance. Representative Biskins, present your bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, House File 3504 is the General Education Access Grants. Madam Chair, we spent considerable time discussing the bill, what its pieces are, and what the components of the bill are all about. Last year, I will tell, and I thank the members of the committee for having that discussion. I'll make it very clear that this bill has not changed as it was originally introduced from last year. There was an amendment put on the bill during committee last year. That amendment is not on the redraft of this bill. And so, Madam Chair, I will defer any questions of the particulars of the bill to the question and answer period rather than spend the committee's time at this point. Madam Chair, I'd just like to say in opening that in the early 1920s, the state of Oregon passed the law which essentially said that every child in the state of Oregon be compelled to attend the public school system. As you can imagine, there was great outcry when that law was passed in the state of Oregon. And the outcry came mainly from upper and middle class, predominantly white citizens of Oregon who were outraged that the state would compel their children to go to state-run schools. Madam Chair and members, this case reached the United States Supreme Court, and in a very famous decision in 1925, the United States Supreme Court, in a case called Pierce versus the Society of Sisters, said the state of Oregon could not compel these families to attend government-run schools. Since 1925, members of this committee, the law of the land of the United States is that people have the freedom to choose their schools. Oh, wait a minute. People of means have the freedom to choose their schools. If you can afford it, you have the ability to choose your schools. And so since 1925, any middle or upper income family in the United States, when a public school is not working for their child, has had the ability to send their child to whatever school is offered, so that they can find the best fit for their child, to give their child the best opportunity that this wonderful country has to offer. Since 1925, members, we've had a two-class education system. And I believe it's time for that to stop. I believe it's time that we offer to the poorest of the poor children in the state of Minnesota the same opportunities that we offer to middle and upper income students. It's the right thing to do. Madam Chair and members, I hope you thoughtfully consider this legislation as we hear testimony on both sides of this issue today, I thank you for allowing me the opportunity to bring this bill forward. Madam Chair, at this time, I'll turn it over to testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Biskins. Members, we will hear the opponents first. That will be from 8:30 to 9 o'clock. And then from 9 to 9:30, we will hear from the proponents of House File 3504. So at this time, I would begin with Dr. William Green, the interim superintendent of St. Paul School Districts. I think he's made it. Please take a seat at the testifying table and say your name into the microphone so we have it on record and begin your testimony. Welcome, Dr. Green.
Good morning. Thank you very much. My name is William D. Green and from Superintendent Minneapolis Public Schools.
My apologies, Dr. Green. I thought it was Minneapolis, but it said St. Paul. Go ahead.
Minneapolis supports public school choice. Minneapolis Public Schools is an expert in school choice. We have offered public school choice since the early 1970s. Desegregation magnet programs in community schools, open enrollment into and out of the district, charter schools, the choice of yours, the NAACP settlement, these are examples of what Minneapolis has done to support the choice for public schools for our students. Minneapolis public school families have public school choice options ranging from magnets to community schools in your neighborhood to inter-district magnets to open enrollment with transportation to neighboring school districts through the Choice of Is Yours program. Public school choice means parents and students choose schools. Private schools choose which students they enroll. Remember the Holy Angels case where twin brothers were admitted, and one's admission was rescinded upon learning that he had a medical condition that required some assistance. Providing taxpayer resources to support parent and student choice without attaching obligations on the part of the education institution to honor that parent's choice is bad public policy. In Minneapolis, public school choice combined with greater accountability through reported testing results and your investments in quality teaching has resulted in successive years of improved test scores and academic performance by students of color and of poverty, students learning English, and special needs students. Minneapolis test results in 2005 demonstrated this, closing achievement gaps for students of color, increasing graduation rates, and removing schools from No Child Left Behind watch lists. In short, public school reforms are working in an adverse environment. State and federal governments have increased mandates to improve student performance while reducing revenue to support greater student performance. Public schools are doing more with less revenue, and the reward is what? In 2003, Minneapolis Public Schools was singled out for the largest cuts of per pupil funding. In 2005 and 2006, Minneapolis Public Schools is being singled for an experiment in private school vouchers. To my friends and partners in private education, I say this. Be careful for what you ask. You just might get it. If you wish to equalize the funding equation between public and private schools, you are begging for the obvious corollary, equalization of the obligation side of the ledger. Public schools that receive public tax dollars are all subject to Pupil Fair Dismissal Act, Public Employee Labor Relations Act, Teacher Tenure Act, Statewide Accountability Testing, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, No Child Left Behind, Americans with Disabilities Act, Open Meeting Law, reporting requirements, too numerous to mention. Private schools are exempted from all of the above, and more on the basis of their private school status. If this bill were to pass, What rationale is there not to extend the mandates associated with public tax dollars? HF 3504 provides a tax subsidy to private schools to do what they already do, select which students they serve. The bill allows them to choose from among families and students with incomes up to $50,000 for a family of four. The proponents of the bill have produced no data that indicates private schools can outperform public schools serving the students we serve, not the students they choose to serve. While Minneapolis public schools can demonstrate a long trend of improved student performance on multiple measures, the same holds. If this bill is enacted, which of our students will our private school partners choose to serve? 67% of our students who are eligible for free and reduced lunch, the 60% of our students' families who have an income under the federal poverty guideline, which is about $20,000 or less, will they choose the 24 out of the 24% of our families who speak over 80 languages other than English? Will they select 16% of our students who qualify today for special education services? And the fastest growing proportion of these are autistic, emotionally and behaviorally disturbed, or have Medicaid reimbursable physical or other health impairments. Will the private schools accept those students? The education reforms of the last 10 years have emphasized making decisions based on data and increasing the accountability for improving student results. HF 3504 flies in the face of existing performance data, reduces accountability for student achievement, and provides a tax incentive for non-public schools to continue to do what they have always done. Select which students they will educate. I want to thank you for this opportunity to speak and open for any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Green. Jennifer Aaron.
My name is Elaine Aaron.
Elaine Aaron. And witnesses, please stay close by for questions. Please go to the testifying table and the page. Give that to the page, please. Welcome, Ms. Aaron, and please identify yourself and the organization which you represent.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Elaine Aaron, and I work at the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota and the Dakotas. I'm the director of our social justice program, Justice Square. The JCRC is the designated public affairs voice of the Jewish community in Minnesota. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify regarding House File 3504. The JCRC is opposed to this legislation. 2 years ago, the JCRC conducted a comprehensive analysis of the issue of school vouchers, tuition tax credits, and other forms of public aid to private schools and private school students, such as the access grants that are contemplated in this legislation. We did so because there are an increasing number of students who attend Jewish day schools. We wanted to review our community's position on aid to private and religious schools, and whether our views should be impacted as a result of our strong support for Jewish education. We held several meetings, heard from rabbis, Jewish educators, public school advocates, and community members. After a thorough review, we concluded that the JCRC should oppose legislation to implement school vouchers and tax credits. We are opposed to House File 3504 for three principal reasons. Number one, public educational funds should go to support public schools. We believe strongly that public dollars are allocated for education should go to public schools. Strong public schools are essential to a healthy democracy and to promote understanding among diverse groups. As a member of a minority religious group, we recognize the importance of public schools. Educational dollars are limited, and providing access grants to encourage students to attend public private schools ultimately diverts money from public education. The best way to strengthen education in this state is to provide money to public schools, not to private schools or to private school students, and to ensure that public dollars go only to educational institutions that do not discriminate in hiring or in the students they serve on the basis of religion or other protected classifications. Vouchers or access grants do not address the issue of low-performing schools. They provide dollars to a limited number of students while not addressing the issues that exist in the schools themselves. Number two, vouchers violate important principles of church-state separation. Approximately 90% of the private schools in Minnesota are religious schools. In addition to the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, Article 13, Section 2 of the Minnesota Constitution is even more specific in prohibiting use of public funds for religious schools. Aside from constitutional concerns, we believe that it is simply not good public policy to devote public dollars to support primarily religious institutions. Number three, House File 3504 is not needed because Minnesota already has many options available for students who want to go to school someplace other than their home district. Minnesota leads the nation in school choice. Alternative schools, charter schools, open enrollment, and the Choice is Yours program, which is specifically applicable to the Minneapolis Public School District. School districts understand that they are in a competitive environment with surrounding school districts, with private schools, and with alternative schools, and respond accordingly with opportunities such as immersion schools, international baccalaureate programs, and other learning opportunities. In summary, after a thorough review of the issue, and despite our knowledge that many members of the Jewish community could benefit from some form of a voucher program, the JCRC concluded that it is best for our community and for Minnesota as a whole that public money go to public schools, and that the Jewish community should accept responsibility for providing a Jewish education for our children. This should not be the responsibility of the state through a voucher, tax credit, or access grant program. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for considering our views.
Thank you, Ms. Aaron. Jennifer Armstrong. Please state your name for the record and identify an organization if you're representing one.
My name is Jennifer Armstrong, and I'm a mom of four kids in four public schools in Minnesota, including one now in the Minsky system. And I'm not representing any organization.
It's good to have parents.
Thank you. I'm here today because I'm perplexed. I understand supply and demand, market economics, and school choice. I understand how competition can push industries to be more competitive and why we need antitrust laws to secure competition in our economy. I also understand accountability and how we need to make sure tax dollars are spent wisely. What I don't understand is how education access grants fit in the context of accountability. There are two central questions of accountability. The first has to do with how we know what we're doing is working. The second has to do with how do we know that we're spending our tax dollars wisely. We have, through No Child Left Behind, developed an accountability system based on the premise that it's not sufficient to judge school quality in the aggregate, that it's necessary to collect and publicly report disaggregated student achievement data based on a host of variables having to do with income, ethnicity, and home language. Indeed, in my mind, it's the disaggregated data that is the most valuable outcome of No Child Left Behind, because it does expose the achievement gap in very stark, undeniable ways. Free market or school choice models are predicated on the idea that parents will select schools for their children based on academics. And yet, when we take a look at what data is available to those parents, we find it's sorely lacking. Even the school report cards developed by the state fail to provide sufficient data for parents to make informed decisions. Without the numbers, without knowing how many students took the test in each of the subgroups, parents have no way of knowing whether a school failed to make AYP based on the scores of 1 to 3 students or 90 or more students. There's no sense of perspective. There's no basis for making an informed decision. That information, by the way, is available at the Minnesota Department of Education website, but you have to know where to go and how to drill down to find it. It seems to me that the very people the Education Access Grants are intended to serve are the people most likely to be without Internet access or the training to know how to manipulate the data to find the answers to the questions they're asking. With respect to private schools, the availability of data is even worse. At the elementary level, it's non-existent. At the high school level, it's limited to ACT, SAT, and now NAEP results. It troubles me how the school report cards cause people to jump to conclusions about schools without digging into the data. It troubles me even more how we have this assumption that all private schools are better than our public schools. A year ago, I looked at the data in St. Paul. I used the 2004 SAT results because it was the only information available to me as a parent. What I found was that of the 5 schools where students scored above 600 in either the math or verbal portions of the test, the average private school tuition was $16,650. What I concluded was that perhaps it takes $16,650 per student to achieve scores over 600 on the SAT. This conclusion is supported by the report released in December that found Minnesota falls short of funding education to achieve the academic standards by $953 million. Again, I am perplexed. How can we say on the one hand, these are the standards we expect our children to accomplish, but then on the other, not provide the funding necessary to accomplish them? I am even more perplexed by those who suggest education access grants will help our most vulnerable children. Do you really expect these parents to make up the difference between the general formula allowance and tuition? That's almost $12,000 per student. What you do expect, I think, is that the education access grants will give these parents access to schools with lower tuition rates. What troubles me is that there is no evidence these schools achieve better academic results than our public schools. Indeed, with the December release of the report on student achievement in private schools based on the NAEP, there's a growing body of evidence that they don't. There are in this discussion, I believe, some areas of common agreement. I believe we all can agree that it's important parents have sound data on which to base informed school choice decisions. To me, that means all schools receiving taxpayer dollars should fully participate in Minnesota's accountability system. It also means modifying the school report cards to provide perspective. I believe we can all agree that it's important to close the achievement gap. We have the state demographer telling us the complexion of Minnesota is changing. We have Minnesota Higher Education Services Office telling us we're not graduating students of color from our state colleges and universities. We have the 2020 caucus telling us we have to prepare for the retirement of the baby boom. I believe we can all agree it's important to use the data to identify the needs to implement sound, research-based strategies for improvement. It troubles me that there's no research to support a correlation between school choice and student achievement. And yet, it's a central tenet of No Child Left Behind and the proposed education access grants. Instead of jumping on the bandwagon of every education reform strategy coming out of Washington, I would like to suggest that we start listening to Minnesota parents. I've spent the past 4 years listening to St. Paul parents, and I can tell you what I've heard. I've heard St. Paul parents say they want their children to see themselves reflected in the diversity of the teaching staff and the curriculum.
Mrs. Armstrong, we have just a couple minutes left for you. Please conclude.
I've heard they want their schools to be welcoming, inviting community buildings that provide family learning opportunities above and beyond the school day. St. Paul has held a number of community conversations about school choice over the past few years. initially because of transportation costs, but more recently because of the inequitable distribution of dollars between neighborhood and magnet schools. What they found was that many parents are choosing magnet schools because the transportation schedule better fits their work schedule. Can you imagine saying to yourself, I'm going to send my child to this magnet school because the extra hour a day they spend on the bus is another hour I have available to work? I can. 70% of the students in St. Paul qualify for free and reduced lunch, not because our parents aren't working, but because they're working minimum wage jobs that don't provide the revenues necessary to support a family. These families' economic realities are reflected in school choice decisions. It troubles me that just as there's insufficient data to support higher student achievement in private schools, there's also, I can't find research to support the premise that parents make school choice on decisions based on academics rather than logistics. Thank you.
Thank you. Kate Powell. Please say your name for the record and begin your testimony. Welcome upstairs.
Thank you, Madame. Pardon?
I think it's better if you sit down because the microphone will be right in front of you then.
Thank you, Madame Chair and committee members, for this opportunity to testify. I'm also a parent in our Twin Cities. I have a child in both the St. Paul and the Minneapolis School District, both public school children. I'm deeply concerned about proposed legislation that would transfer public subsidies to private schools. Schools are not intended to be a market-driven enterprise. Research on school choice has found that approaching education as a free market enterprise deepens existing inequities and creates two-tier systems that deepen racial divides. Researcher Jeff Witte, who has researched school choice both within the United States and in Great Britain and New Zealand, has found little evidence that increasing educational markets increases student achievement. In fact, his research proves out that educational markets deepen racial divides. In January 2006, Professors Sarah and Christopher Lubienski from the University of Illinois released results of their research of more than 340,000 students in 13,000 regular public charter and private schools. When children of similar socioeconomic status were compared, public school children scored higher in math than private school fourth and eighth graders on the standard NAEP, the National Assessment of Educational Progress tests. Our public schools have standards and accountability, both for the money they spend on children and for monitoring and improving educational outcomes. Private schools do not. Private schools control which students to admit and can make a student leave for any number of reasons. They are not bound by the same state requirements for teacher qualifications or support to our most vulnerable students. Public schools are community and neighborhood institutions whose support extends beyond the school, staff, and students to adult education, civic meetings, and family resources. With large-scale voucher programs, higher-income private students receive an increase in income at the expense of the poorest students. This per-student investment decreases significantly, forcing them into further poverty and breaking up neighborhoods. Providing uniform quality education in Minnesota is a state constitution mandate. Minnesota scores in the top five consistently for school choice. That's not our problem. Vouchers recycle institutional classism and lower our state standards for being accountable to each and every student. Vouchers, in my mind, are a distraction from the real work of supporting our students and uplifting them in their own communities. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll call forward now some folks from the St. Paul School District. Alana Street, Stewart, Valina Silva, Sharon Freeman, and Marla Castro. And ladies, you'll have to keep in mind that we have 6 minutes remaining. And we still need to hear from Education Minnesota and the School Boards Association.
Good morning,
please,
Madam
please
Chair and committee members. They're going to join me here.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and begin.
I am Alana Street Stewart. I'm Chair of the School Board in St. Paul. On behalf of the school district, we respectfully oppose this bill as an instructional strategy and policy matter that provides vouchers for certain students with income qualifications in St. Paul and Minneapolis. You've already heard testimony that vouchers are critical to force the district to reform its public schools. Well, St. Paul Public Schools takes this mission seriously, and we provide all of our students with a world-class education, access to a world of opportunities, and an inclusive learning environment that reflects the culture, language, and intellectual contributions of all of our students. And under the leadership, as you know, of our former superintendent, Dr. Patricia Harvey, St. Paul is well ahead of the nation in adopting reforms that improve student achievement. We already have a bold and aggressive position to institute both site-based management and budgeting in a very competitive academic market. We know that you can't hold schools accountable until you give them the power to develop their own budgets, hire staff, and make other important academic decisions. Therefore, we already have a high expectation that school options are more effective when families and community leaderships have complete information about school quality. And how are we doing? I do have parents here and a principal and a director of our ELL services to share that information with you. We have a model professional development program that's comprehensive, intensive, and provides ongoing training and support to teachers. We are also successful in addressing grassroots efforts to ensure choices. Our nationally recognized Chosen to Achieve program started by parents in a church basement, and that has grown as a district-wide initiative to mentor African-American students. If programs like these had the confidence of you as legislators to know that what they are doing together with us as a school district is the right thing, then future funding for their students wouldn't have to rely on the competitive market of grants. We know what works, and it has been brutal for our site teams that have been forced to dismantle or to reduce opportunities for instruction based on funding opportunities for our students. We have 23% of the state of Minnesota's nationally board-certified teachers. That is almost one quarter of your state's numbers. Research has shown that they prove that they make access and achievement much more possible for those students beyond the typical classroom success. So currently, families have a number of public school choices here in our school district. All of our secondary schools and nearly two-thirds of our elementary schools are available as citywide options. In fact, we believe that St. Paul has one of the oldest and most successful systems of school choice in the nation. So at this time, I'd like to offer the opportunity for my other guests to join you and make their comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stewart. Ms. Silva, please identify.
Yes, my name, good morning, everybody. My name is Valeria Silva. I'm the Director of English Language Learners for the St. Paul Public Schools. But also, I'm a parent of a public school student. I'm very proud of it. I can only tell you that what we have been able to do in St. Paul with the student gains of the ELL students, English language learners, it has been amazing. The reason why I'm here today is not to reiterate what you all know about our performance of ELL students, but also to show you that a couple days ago, Great City Schools put out a report in which it's called the Beating the Odds, in which it describes the performance for all school districts who are over 45 to more students in the nation. And what they did is they analyzed the data and they look at all the test scores from all the students across the nation. And once again, St. Paul schools, in all the test data that we have from all those school districts, came up to be the first in the nation of closing the achievement gap between English speakers and non-English speakers. This is, for us, a very, very proud moment, because every year in the last 8 years I've been this job, our funding has been diminished. And even though with this funding being diminished, we have been able to get the students to achieve higher standards. And they are not different standards. The standards are for English speakers and non-English speakers. And when you look at the data and you see that the gap between the English-speaking and non-English-speaking students is closing, you realize we have a very strong professional development and academic program from our teachers. We also face one of the most unique populations in the United States, and it's the fact that we have 102 languages, and majority of our students are Hmong, which is a language that has no literacy, academic literacy, written, and that implies that we have to do something different. And today, when we look at the opportunities our kids are having, knowing that the possibilities of losing funding again for our kids is on the way by proposing this new situation, it is really, really destroying the ability to think that I'm a new American. I came to this country thinking and knowing that the reason why I was here is because public school was the choice, the opportunity for kids to come out of poverty. And if we are every time in diminishing the amount of dollars that we get to be able to educate the kids, I don't know how we can do the job. Thank you for listening, and I'll pass it to the next person.
Ms. Freeman, and we have no time left, so you have to hurry along, please, so we can stay on our agenda.
Thank you. And I'm happy to be here because in front of you, data speaks. I am the principal of Prosperity Heights. You're sitting there with the data from our school. I'm not going to go through data, but I want you to take a look at it. If you turn to the page of our summary for 2005 AYP data, it has all students. Please take a look at the index rate. As you see at Prosperity Heights, there is no achievement gap for any of our children. And I'll give you a minute to take a look at that. And I'd like you to take a look also to see that our percentage of free and reduced lunch is 83%. Again, look at the data. There is no achievement gap. We have 35% Asian. Again, no achievement gap. We have 25% African American. Look at how they did. Data speaks for itself. We are doing what needs to be done in St. Paul School.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. That will end our testimony for those who oppose House File 3504. We would ask those who support House File 3504 to prepare to come to the witness stand. And we'll begin with Ms. Erica Moss. And Alana Singra, you're on deck.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members.
Please say your name for the record and begin, please.
Erica Moss. Madam Chair and members, in 2004, I set out to model and measure the fiscal impact of a voucher pilot similar but not identical with House File 3504. My purpose in doing so was not to make an argument for school choice as a means of saving money, one of the charges most frequently made by opponents of vouchers, but to design a bill specifically suited to Minnesota's unique demographics, educational history, existing infrastructure, and funding formulas. The bill I modeled has many of the elements included in the bill before the committee today, a bill that, in my opinion, is the most progressive and reasonable voucher proposal currently considered in state legislatures. The bill I modeled has many of the elements included in the bill before, I relied upon such experts as Carolyn Minter Hoxby of Harvard, Gerard Robinson and Howard Fuller of Marquette University, and Dr. John Brandel of the Humphrey Institute for the assessment that giving low-income parents, and especially parents of color, greater control over where and how their children are educated has demonstrable benefits for individual children and groups of students. My goal was a model grant principled both practically and with regard to issues of established constitutionality, justice, and equal access. First, the grants must be large enough to make participation by families at the lowest income levels feasible. Access for families receiving the grants must be stable and predictable. The enabling legislation must provide for stability of funding for district schools children with grants leave, administration of the tuition grants must be simple, transparent, and verifiable. And the enabling legislation must avoid problems experienced elsewhere in the country by providing orderly expansion if demand for access increases. I have copied a few pages from the study for the committee. Keep in mind that there are some differences in the details of my model and the bill before you that change the fiscal calculations, but the policy implications remain valid. It's the policy implications that are most interesting to me and most relevant to the criticisms of both this bill and the concept of vouchers for parental choice. I researched a number of demographic factors that do not appear in the published study, but which are essential to the design of the bill, of a bill that provides for children who opt out and those who remain behind in the district schools. In the first district-wide voucher program in Milwaukee, there have been several problems with the enabling legislation. These problems can be avoided in Minneapolis and St. Paul's particular circumstances. Minnesota has a vigorous non-public school sector with a significant number of high-performing, low-tuition schools with an easy use of families in those districts. Milwaukee had fewer schools of choice and less variety in their curricula and affiliations. In fact, most Milwaukee schools did not agree to accept voucher students. And here it's worth noting an oddity of that city. Milwaukee public school teachers, unlike those in Minneapolis and St. Paul, must reside within the district to teach there. Among the schools that refuse to accept vouchers are private schools in which a majority of students are the children of teachers employed by the district. About 80% of the non-public schools in Minneapolis and St. Paul charge tuition that is already less than the state's basic per-pupil formula, providing a variety of schools already being chosen by tuition-paying families and avoiding the problem of low capacity experienced in Cleveland, Milwaukee, and Florida, as well as the problem of voucher schools of a questionable quality being established opportunistically. Minnesota, unlike Florida or Arizona, also has a robust charter school sector that has prepared our Department of Education to oversee payments for schools of choice and an exemplary system of oversight for charitable organizations, including non-public schools. The bill allows only students of low income, by definition at risk, to leave district schools with a voucher. It does not permit middle-class flight from district schools at public expense. The bill is not designed as aid to private schools. Use or transfer of funds are solely the discretion of the parent according to state processes. Unlike bills elsewhere, this bill provides stability revenue for children not opting out of district schools. In Minneapolis, local dollars stay behind and only state general fund dollars follow the student. No more than tuition and only tuition up to the amount of the basic per pupil formula leaves. The district continues to receive stability revenue for 3 years after any one student leaves. The last thing I would like to say is less about policy and is a more direct response to a common criticism of voucher proposals. That is that vouchers take money from public schools. The policy answer is, and the bill is designed so that access grants don't have to take more money than is necessary to educate the students who choose private education. It is important to talk about exactly how this money would be taken from public schools. Most of the people in this room understand, although it is rarely talked about like this, that public schools receive money from the state to educate each child that shows up in a particular district. It follows then that when a parent whose child is attending public school decides that they want their child to instead attend private school, the public school mostly no longer receives money from the state to educate that child. This happens if the child is from an upper middle class family or from a low income family. This bill would allow 3% of low-income students in each Minneapolis and St. Paul to choose to take some of the money the state has designated for their education away from public schools. According to testimony, opponents are very confident that if given a chance, parents would choose to take their children and subsequently money elsewhere. I have to agree with this assessment. In the 2 years that I did outreach for this movement, I never met a parent who would qualify for this access grant who didn't at least want it for their neighbor. Parents are tired of waiting for policymakers to fix this for them. They know what they need, and they know they need it immediately. If I were in a similar situation, I wouldn't wait either, and I wouldn't have to because I would have the money I needed to buy access. If money is the obstacle to giving the most vulnerable what they want, I say give them the money to buy access and let the kids go. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moss. Ms. Singrai. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Alona Singroy. I am the mother of 7 children and a resident of South Minneapolis. My family has very little money, but with the help of a lot of people and the support of other private schools, and through great personal financial sacrifice, I have raised children who excel their studies and who anyone here would be proud to represent them publicly. I want you to pass this bill, Access Grant, because it benefits other inner-city urban kids whose parents know what they need, a safe and orderly environment in which to get a good foundational learning. Early, who cannot get this quickly enough from the schools we currently have in the cities. I am convinced that my oldest daughter would not now be in college with advanced placement for pre-medical studies if she had remained in our district public school, which I keenly scrutinized when her first attendance of public school and nothing had fit my curriculum. She is now 18 and she is in pre-medical classes at her college. I firmly believe that my son would not be a talented musician, an academically excellent with a 4.0 at high school, at his private high school, if he had attended the local public schools. He might be at the top of the class there. But what is the point of being the top of a low heap? Our family would not be united in clear behavioral expectations if my children were exposed daily to the behaviors of peers with values very different from those my family worked towards, and the teachers who don't control classes or who have low expectations for children of poor minority families. And many of you sitting here before us are yourself teachers, are retired teachers, or who are telling us we should just be satisfied with the status quo that benefits you. That is good enough. But would it be good enough if we just give the same people more money to run it? But you don't have to send your own children into these schools. We urban parents are trying to promote healthy living for future generations. We want to avoid our children becoming repeat recipients of welfare and social services. We want our children to have the foundation to be prepared to not only graduate from high school with a real high school education, and not just to begin college, but to able to complete the study and be successful in later life in whatever work they are best equipped and talented to perform. To listen to the opposition talk, the district schools are victims of bad parents and low budget and unfair criticism. The lobbyists for the status quo act as if parents like me, are ignorant or greedy. Low-income parents shouldn't have to settle for watching these children barely get by. We deserve more of the choices. Senator Steve Kelly and Representative Keith Allison and Mayor Archie Rideback and Senator Edward Kennedy and Jesse Jackson can afford to make their own children. We deserve Access Grant. Please consider our children. If this program is in Milwaukee and this program is already in D.C., Washington, D.C., why not Minnesota? And I'm speaking to each and every one of the legislator here today, that all of us should consider this. But without working together, there's not going to be any success. So I'm asking, please consider our children, not your next election, by the teachers' union when you vote on this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity of being here.
Don Samuels. Welcome to the committee, and please say your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and all the members of this committee. Thank you for indulging me this morning. I'm a parent of three African-American children. They've all been in private schools.
Mr. Samuels, will you say your name for the record?
Yes, I'm Don Samuels. I'm a city council member for the 5th Ward in North Minneapolis, which I guess is our equivalent of the 9th Ward in New Orleans. And we can see what happened when people didn't have choices a few months ago, and those kind of absence of choices continue to haunt communities like ours. I have three children. One is 30, one is 6, and one is 7, and one is 5. And they've all been and are in private schools. And yet, even while my 30-year-old son was in St. Paul Academy, where he did very well, for 3 years I was a co-chair of the curriculum committee of the St. Paul Public Schools. And for 3 other years, I tutored African-American boys from St. Paul Public Schools in junior high grades, 150 each Saturday at Central High School, for 3 hours. That's because I believe that the public schools should be as good as they can be. But when I took my son to the public schools available, I didn't think I would take the risk with his life for the percentage of success that they offered. I know this is a political liability for me, as I'm sure it would be for many of you who are here today. I'm a Democrat. But my loyalty to the kids of my community is greater than the loyalty to the party. My wife and I live in the Jordan neighborhood. You know Jordan. Mm-hmm. 9 level 3 sex offenders in a few square blocks, gunshots, a greatly disproportionate amount of public housing, concentration of poverty. Would you live there? We do. We have a choice, and we chose to live there. Most people who have a choice move. And in fact, in speaking with a local employer recently, he said that once his employees get to $20 an hour, they move to the suburbs. They're making a choice. I don't hold it against them. I believe people should make a choice. The problem is most of the people who are left in Jordan are there because they don't have a choice. And they send their children to the schools because they don't have a choice. I have a choice. I live in Jordan. My wife and I are taking that risk. And yet we don't think we can afford the risk of sending our children to the schools in Jordan. And we are sacrificial people. We're doing what many of you wouldn't do already. And we don't think we can take that risk. I am a Democrat. I am a member of the party of choice. The pro-choice party. Pro-choice before conception, and it should be pro-choice after conception. How can we give a woman, a single mom, a right to decide whether or not life is just and fair and nurturing in her community and society and circumstance to bring a child or not into the world? And then after that child comes into the world, we will deny that same woman the choice to decide whether or not the schools in her community are just and nurturing enough to guarantee her child a success in life. If we're going to be pro-choice, let's be pro-choice. And for my Democratic friend, my Republican friends, if you're pro-life before conception, well, be pro-quality of life after conception. Give the kids a chance before they're born. Give the kids a chance after they're born. This is certainly one issue where both parties can defend their positions together and come out on the same side. I'm going to quote a famous teacher that many of you might recognize. Children are not created for public schools. Public schools were created for children. At every juncture, the priority is the child. And as that great teacher did, he violated convention and tradition and norms in the interest of people. And today, I am violating my political possibilities, I guess you could say. I am violating my party's position. And I'm violating a lot of conventional wisdom for the deep-seated commitment to the children of my community. When the waters flooded the Ninth Ward, the poor children floated up to the dome, and we saw how ugly the absence of choice of transportation was. Today, there's another flood in our community. They're not in Metrodome, but they're in the prisons in Stillwater and St. Cloud. I ask you to stop this nonsense, and let's take care of our children. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Samuels. Liz King. Welcome to the committee, Mr. King. Please say your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Louis J. King II. I reside at 7963 Drake Road in Woodbury, Minnesota. I grew up as a poor kid in Florida. My first job was as a shoeshine boy. From there, I went to the tomato fields. I come from a blue-collar family. My mother worked in a glass plant. My grandfather was a teamster. My grandmother was a custodian with the school district. All the men in my family were merchant marines. I was the first to go to college, and they called me Joe College for a long time. I graduated from Morehouse College in 1982 and became an Army officer. In 1989, I was assigned to the University of Minnesota as an ROTC recruiting instructor. It was to be a three-year tour, and as I told some of you yesterday, it's been 17 years, and my grandmother hasn't gotten over it yet. It was through my experience as a recruiter that I traveled from Chisago to Lakeville and Woodbury to Watertown. This was the first time that I noticed the different Minnesotas, inner city, suburban, and rural. I was struck by the lack of preparation that I found in the children in the inner city. They simply were not ready to compete. In many instances, they were not taking what I considered to be the core subjects, math, English, and science. They said they were done. In 1982, I resigned my commission to work full-time in the community. For the record, I have worked in the same low-income neighborhood as a volunteer or professional for the last 17 years. My service includes coaching baseball, leading my neighborhood association, and serving as an elected school board member in Minneapolis. Bill Green, the superintendent of schools in Minneapolis, is my friend and mentor. And he taught me a great deal about policy, politics, and also friendship. Along the way, I discovered that the absence of work was the greatest factor affecting families. Implicitly, education goes hand in hand with work. I work with the wealthy and the poor, and we all believe that the best social service program in the world is a job. For the people I represent, the 50% graduation rate for African-American children is unacceptable. We have worked for years and invested hundreds of thousands of dollars to help these children succeed. The time is now to exhaust every available option to reverse this tragedy. In my opinion, vouchers provide the opportunity for low-income families to enjoy the same benefits as the middle class and wealthy, access to options outside of the public schools. It will put 85% of the private schools within reach of these families. I might add that none of the African-American people in my immediate circle have their children enrolled in the public schools of Minneapolis or St. Paul. And this ranges from the affluent to former gang members. They are either in charter schools or people have simply chosen not to live in the district. Where possible, they are paid for private schools or have received scholarships. Some argue that vouchers will destroy the public schools. This is not true. In fact, for the 50% of African-American kids who will not graduate, some might argue that the schools are already ruined. The current proposal would have a 5% cap, which would affect around 2,200 kids in Minneapolis. The Star Tribune article dated November 4, 2003 offers a far more ominous picture than the threat of the proposed measure. Poor African Americans are already voting with their feet, and recently published reports show more of the same. The people opposing this measure don't get it. The horse has already left the barn. Education has always been, is today, and will continue to be a core value in the African-American struggle for equality. Our struggle for equality began in pit schools, which were literally holes in the ground used at night as gathering places for people to learn while the master slept. We should not forget our determination as demonstrated in Brown v. Topeka, Kansas. And now today we embrace the charter movement initiatives such as the West Metro Enrollment Program and vouchers. We have examples of successful programs in Milwaukee, Ohio, Florida, and the District of Columbia. We understand there is no silver bullet. More importantly, though, we understand that the current situation is not working, and we have to act. This is another leg in our epic journey as a people. For us, this fight is neither about unions nor is it about partisan politics. It is about the struggle of people to use any means necessary to ensure that their children have access to quality education. In the current scenario, we can literally walk into a kindergarten class filled with African-American children and tell half of them to proceed to the first grade. The other half, we would say, not so fast. We could say to them, go straight to jail or to the welfare lines. Get straight to the main event and become fodder for the misery management machine. And what do I mean by that? I joke with my county commissioner friends in Minneapolis that if black folks had their act together, there'd be a lot of people on unemployment at the county. They manage our lives. And it's simply unacceptable. Interestingly enough, some would argue that it's not the schools, but the state of the family that is at the root of the issue. I concur. But let us not overlook the fact that for the most part, these families are poorly educated. If we are truly interested in breaking the cycle, let's ensure that the next generation of children is well educated, and let's not limit our options. Further, it is ironic that many who oppose exploring every option to secure good education for African-American kids will later engage in a spirited debate to provide social programs for poor families. Others will argue to get tough on crime and to limit benefits. When you peel back all the layers, this boils down to debates about jobs in the public schools, jobs in the justice system, jobs in the welfare system, and jobs in the child support system. Jobs for everybody but us. Clearly, you can understand our position. We will not sit quietly as our future is gambled away. If this option is not provided, we will flock to charter schools, utilize the WeMap initiative, or simply move out of the core cities. African Americans have no choice but to pursue every possible avenue. Remember, we started learning in pits and rose to the Supreme Court. This battle, too, will be won. The question is not if, but merely when. The only remaining question is, are you with us? Please support this measure.
Thank you, Mr. King. Our last testifier on the proponent side is Ms. Sandra Samuels. Please state your name for the record and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Sandra Hollinger Samuels, and I'll be really brief. I was here last year, and I'm getting a little choked up because I came here today knowing that this bill probably will not pass in terms of votes from this floor. I know that there's a significant number of you who have made commitments to teachers and to unions that this bill does not pass. I am not too proud to tell you that the reason I am here is because I am not only a member of BAEO, Black Alliance for Educational Options, which is a national organization that is saying black children are lagging so far behind. We need every option available to us to fix this problem, and we can't wait. My daughter is in the first grade. The other one is going into kindergarten. My neighbors who live around me, how much longer should they have to wait for the public school systems to get it right? We are less than half of our children are graduating, not just here, but around the country. I talked to a representative from this committee yesterday who said, I just don't know if this will work. What we do know, as far as black and brown children are concerned, we know that the public school is not working. That part we do know. And I'm here to tell you that our kids are dying and we are languishing. I live in a community with black children, descendants of slaves. I am a descendant of slaves here today, talking because we as a country have unfinished business. The kids in my community cannot speak English, and they did not come here from Mexico. They were born here. And they, unlike myself and my husband, do not have the wherewithal to send their children to a parochial school. And when I hear people, or a private school, and I hear people say, well, we don't know. There's no proof. There is proof. We have the luxury of sending our daughter to Ascension in North Minneapolis, where they, too, have 80-85% free and reduced lunch, where they, too, have the largest bevy of black and brown children. But they're our kids there pass at 85% on the first test, on in every test, unlike the public school system where less than half pass. We do have proof. As a mother, as a member of Bail, as an American, as a black woman, what I tell you is that we just need some help and some relief now. And I am for public schools. I am for public schools, quality, charter, homeschooling, whatever it takes for our kids not to languish and to continue languishing. And I know that you all have made some commitments. And I hope, I am praying that your commitment as an American, as a parent, is that if your child were forced to go to a local public school that you knew was failing year after year after year, what would you do? All we are asking is that for the poorest in our community, a small percentage, that you give them the choice to say, I choose to send my child somewhere else where they will be educated. Today we heard from the superintendent of the Minneapolis School Board, interim. He had to say what he said because he represents the school district. We heard from parents, a white parent who talked about there's no data for poor parents to really decide. My proof is in my child when she comes home and she can't read. I don't have to go read some data about how well she is or isn't doing. And by the way, you do remember that 73%, that only 27% of the children in Minneapolis-St. Paul school districts are white, right? You know that 73% are brown and black. And today, when think about the testimony that you heard overwhelmingly, you can look overwhelmingly, who's here saying we need help but the people who are most impacted? And in closing, I just want to say that this is not just, like I said, yes, I'm black, yes, I'm a descendant of slaves, but I am an American. And what I know is that as Americans, we are falling woefully behind the rest of the industrialized nations. Only 18%, we ranked 18th in reading internationally, 22nd in science internationally, 28th in math, behind many other countries. We need a change now. And I beg you, I'm not asking you, I beg you, I humble myself before you, let this thing get off this floor at least. Let us talk about it. Because I tell you, come visit, I invite you all, come visit us in Jordan, please.
Thank you,
so that
Daniel.
You can see.
Thank
you very much.
Members, we now have about 10 minutes for questions. And please call forth in your question the testifier you would like. Representative Biscus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, a few things have been pointed out that I'd like to address, if I may, at this time. The first is the statement that there is no research that shows that these students, that these types of programs raise achievement. I guess if you don't look for research, you don't find research. Obviously, people must not be looking because both research at both Harvard and research at Marquette both show that the voucher programs not only raise the achievement level of the students who receive the voucher, but also through the competition raise the achievement level of the regular public school system. This bill raises all boats. And for people to come up to this table and say there's no research, basically they're saying, I didn't take the time to look for the research because it's there. The other thing I'd like to point out, Madam Chair and members, is the whole constitutionality issue. The constitutionality of voucher programs have gone through the U.S. Supreme Court on a number of occasions and have been shown to indeed not violate the U.S. Constitution. They have been found to be constitutional, and there is no public involvement in private schools. These vouchers go to the parents, and the parents decide what they're going to do with it. And the parents could decide that it goes to the public school where they are residents, or the parents could decide that it goes to a private school. It's a parent decision, and it's no more an intrusion than the state were to say, and a parent on food stamps can only use their food stamps at Cubs Food. Well, no, we let parents use their food stamps at whatever grocery store they want to use them at. They can use their vouchers at whatever school they'd like to use them at. And the last thing I'd like to address, Madam Chair, and I think this needs to be clearly stated, is that anyone who would have the audacity to come up here and wave their hat on the Blaine Amendment of the state constitution needs to do a little research as to where the Blaine Amendment in our Minnesota state constitution came from. This was a national movement with pure racism at heart. This was a national movement meant to prevent students from going to predominantly Catholic, Lutheran, and Jewish private schools. That is the origin of the Blaine Amendment, and to hang your hat on that, I think, is a little bit frustrating. Madam Chair, at this time, there are amendments in the package. We can deal with those, or I can stand for questions.
Representative Diskins, thank you. We'll hold off on the amendments because we do have a couple of legislators with questions. Representative Quincy, and please identify if you need someone who testified to come forth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the principal of Prosperity Heights and also a question for Ms. Powell.
Just a minute, Representative Cleansing. Let's let the ladies get to the testifying table. And ladies, you'll have to re-identify yourselves for the sake of the tape. So,
Sharon Freeman, Principal of Prosperity Heights.
And Representative Cleansing, your question.
Thank you. Ms. Freeman, first I want to say just congratulate you on the good job that your results are showing that you're doing there at Prosperity Heights.
Thank you.
And I think that that's the kind of success that some of the parents here today are hoping to find for their students. And certainly they're finding it at your public school at Prosperity Heights. How long do you think it would take for us to get those results at all the other public schools where these students who are similar to the population that you have need it? Because we have pretty high number of students who aren't getting what students are getting at Prosperity Heights. How could we replicate that, and how quickly could it be done? And if you could consider maybe some of the political pushback that might happen as we tried to do that in the time frame that you give us.
Principal?
Again, I am talking on behalf of St. Paul Public Schools. We have a reform model that is happening at St. Paul Public Schools for the Project for Academic Excellence. Every school right now is doing, in St. Paul Public Schools on the elementary level, is doing a program, Reader's Workshop, Writer's Workshop, and Math Workshop. Our teachers are trained. There's staff development that is being done at the district level. This is why we have scores like that. Besides having a site council, I have a member today of our site council. I have involved parents. Also at Prosperity Heights, I'm a neighborhood school. I have community involvement. When you put all of those pieces together, you get test scores like this. There is, again, no achievement gap at Prosperity Heights. But all the pieces must work, and St. Paul Public Schools has all the pieces working, and we have all the pieces in St. Paul Public Schools along with at Prosperity Heights.
Representative Clemson, you have a question for Ms. Powell?
Thank you, and I just want to say that still didn't answer the question about how long it's going to take to get this for all the kids who are in a situation where they need what's being provided for them there. Ms. Tal, do you have any students in a charter school?
Ms. Tal, please identify.
Do I have? Yes, I do. A public charter. And I wanted to know, we had a lot of similar testimony I wasn't here at the time, but was watching the argument and the debate, because it took me a while to come along on the bandwagon supporting the public charter schools at the time in the 90s. There was a lot of arguments that were very similar to what we're hearing right now about this little skim students off the top, that charter schools will be selective and not in terms of their criteria for selecting students, but that the parents who opt out into those charter schools will be kind of self-selective. They're the kind of parents who look for options and look for initiatives, which can be a slightly different parent at times. And I was wondering if you've seen that phenomenon occur now that we've had charter schools for 2 years. Have any of these concerns that charter schools would do this and cause great tragedy for the regular public schools, has that occurred with the charter school movement?
Ms. Tal.
I can't speak to the overall charter movement, but I can speak to my daughter's school. And I can tell you that one of the reasons it's been an uncomfortable experience for me and why I've considered even putting her back into a Minneapolis public school is because there have been issues of racial equity at her school. In the first year of our operation, we actually had a very, very difficult time recruiting and retaining students of color, which was a great concern to me. And even though we have a lottery system from which we select our students, that lottery can only be successful in recruiting students of color if we attract a great deal of students of color to apply to the school in the first place. And that's been very, very difficult. And it's been, I have spoken to students of color at our school who feel very alienated because they don't see a student population or a teacher population that reflects their heritage. And that's an issue that we will continue to work on. I can say that I have a lot of respect for what some of my opponents say, including the Samuels. I have seen the issues that they speak to in our Minneapolis public schools. And I believe as a white person that it's my responsibility to live in the city, to live in areas where I can work together with families of color to lift up neighborhoods and to lift up children right within their communities. And I'm concerned about, from my own experience in moving a daughter to a charter school, that was my experiment with greater choice in our family. I've been very, very disturbed by the homogeneity of the school and the difficulty to bring a diverse population to that environment.
Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just have a couple of quick questions. I'm kind of looking for some numbers, and I don't know who can answer, but one of them is I know there are about roughly 80,000 students in the Minneapolis-St. Paul schools. I'm wondering how many of them are from households under 250% of the poverty guideline, if that information is available, or how close can you get me to...
Can I answer what I know of that?
Yes.
Ms. Tal.
Please.
We have 67% of students who receive free and reduced lunches, three-quarters of which live in extreme poverty. We have 4,500 plus, it's about 4 students who are homeless and highly mobile. My concern, quite frankly, with access grants is not so much for middle-class families of color, but for the very, very poor who, even if provided this choice, would not have the support to make it to those private parochial schools. I firmly believe that our best bet is to support them and uplift them in their own communities and to work and foster quality education within those schools, whatever it takes. And it's going to take some time, but we're on the right track.
Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the closest I can get, and that's fine, is that about 65% are at 150%, then 65% of the 41,000 or whatever it is at St. Paul would get me at least in the ballpark, and then whatever additional number of students are between 150 250. I wonder if anybody from the private schools can tell me how many students we're talking about in Minneapolis, St. Paul private schools, and then how many of those students are at or below the 250% threshold. I'm trying to figure out.
Yes, I believe we have someone who
Bill does or doesn't do.
Thank you, lady. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed to answer.
Madam Chair, Peter Noel, Minnesota Catholic Conference, Education Director, and in response to Representative Dorn's question, the children in our Catholic schools, I can speak from that perspective at any rate, in the core city would be coming right from the neighborhood, so they would represent the same constituent that you'd find in the public school system. I think you heard Ms. Samuels identify some of the profile of the families and so forth in Ascension School. The same is true for many of our other Catholic schools in that area.
Madam Chair, can you tell me then what is the total enrollment? I take 65% of just to even get the 150% calculation.
Well, I can tell you what the enrollment in the Archdiocese, which covers the Seven County metro area, I can't break that down, I don't think, for you in the two districts.
That's fine.
But that would be about 36,000 students, kindergarten through 12th grade.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dorn. Very quickly, Representative Markwart.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I don't know who this is a question for sure to, but it's kind of along these same lines. I'm interested on the process, so maybe Representative Biskins can answer that.
Certainly.
You know, it talks about certainly an application process where the commissioner must act on applications properly submitted in the form and manner the commissioner prescribes, and then later on there's the guardian or parent have to submit information regarding to validate the cost and so forth. And my concern here is just how that would work, because you're going to have students who parents are not interested, are not with it as far as doing anything with the school, and you're going to have also other students whose parents are going to be very interested. So if you've got an application process and things have to be filled out just right, you're going to have certain children who are going to have certain benefits over those whose parents are not interested or involved. So what protection would be in this application process to make sure that the very poorest with the parent who isn't involved would have the same, basically, application rights or entrance into this as someone else?
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Markwart, the guarantee comes in the experience of the department in working with a variety of option packages which already occur. The one I can think of in particular is the PSEO program, where students, no matter what their income level, can take college classes and have the state pay for them while they're in high school. And it doesn't matter their income level. So the state already has processes. They have experience working with students from very, very low income families to very high income families. I would rely on their expertise.
Representative Markwart.
And thank you very much for that. But now, for example, just the application, is that going to be sent to every student who would qualify, or is it going to be in the newsletter the district sends out? Or, I mean, just how is that actually going to work? Is that the details are kind of the key to this? I mean, how would that actually take me maybe this has worked somewhere else. How does that actually get out to the students or the parents, the information?
Representative Ziskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Marquardt, I don't believe we would need a specific process spelled out by law. Number one, I think that'd almost be condescending to intelligent people. And the beauty of it is that historically, and not just in the United States, but throughout the world, the word of freedom spreads rather quickly. Those who are interested would find ways. There are plenty of support organizations within the Minneapolis and St. Paul area who would help these poor families if this is something they're interested in, follow and complete the process.
Representative Dimmer. This is the last question.
Madam Chair, I'll pass.
Thank you, Representative Dimmer. And we have some amendments in front of us. Committee, the H3504A1 amendment. Who lays claim to that? Representative Greiling, please present your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is my amendment, and in the interest of time and the fact that we had this bill last year, we also had this amendment last year, I decided to not offer it, but I just put it out there to make a point.
Thank you, Representative Greiling. We have the H3504A2 amendment, and who lays claim to that?
Madam Chair, that's my amendment. I also will defer that amendment at this time.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Biscuit.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, I just want to put this in some Joe layman's around the kitchen table, you know, common sense reasoning that I think we all can understand. Members of the committee, Madam Chair, once upon a time, there was a very, very powerful nation. And this nation, this government, believed that they were the absolute best form of government that they could put before their people. And in fact, they believed it so strongly that they put up an iron curtain so that their people would be compelled to live under this absolutely glorious governmental system. Of course, we here in the West scoffed at the Soviet Union, and we said, hey, if you're so good, tear down the wall. Tear down the wall. See which way the people run. Members of this committee, I beg you to look into your heart. Look around this committee room at people who passionately care about their children. They care, and they only want what's best. If the public school system is what is best for their child, they will choose the public school system. They care. They truly do. Why are we afraid? Why are we afraid of giving the poorest of the poor a choice? Madam Chair, members of this committee, to quote a very famous politician, tear down this wall. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Biskins renews his motion. I'm sorry.
I'm just putting my hand out. If I could just have make a couple of comments, and then I would ask for a roll call vote. I think
yes, Representative Dorn asked for a roll call. Go ahead, Representative Dorn.
Madam Chair, a few quick comments in looking at it. I do believe the bill is not ready for prime time, and I would say that just to say it once for the record, that has nothing to do in my mind with any commitment I made because I didn't to my party, and has nothing to do with anything dealing with any union. Members, I won't get into the fact that I have more aunts and uncles in Mankato than Representative Rukavina has in his district, because that would be a lot of stories. But all 28 of my cousins and myself, my three brothers and sister, went to public schools, with one exception. At a certain, when he was a 10th grader, my younger brother was part of a quality improvement initiative, and they thought they could improve the school significantly if he would go to the public school. So he left. But it does have to do, and I do the numbers real quickly, if I take 65% of the current enrollees, we're talking over 50,000 kids. I see the bill providing possible access to about 2,400 if I do 3% of that. And that doesn't include however many more would be above that threshold. And as I read the bill, this is for students who are enrolled in public schools, so I'm not sure what that means for all the students who are currently enrolled in private schools, but probably that they wouldn't be eligible. I just, I would encourage a no vote. I think this needs further work, and I hope the members consider those arguments.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your comments, Representative Dorn, that you do identify some concerns, but given the nature of this issue, I think we have to start somewhere. And I just want to submit a question for everybody to consider before they vote. Is there any conceivable way that we can make absolutely certain that public schools can truly serve all students, in every situation, with every conceivable need? Is that even conceivably possible? I think it's not. First thought for some of you might be more money, more funding. But I think it's not, no matter how much money we provide. And the data that confirms that is when the new contemporary definition of the First Amendment was established in the 60s, and you look at the charts of crime and other sociological problems that came. And I'll submit to you one example that's right here in our Twin Cities. Minnesota Teen Challenge. Minnesota Teen Challenge proves by their work and what they call their ministry that there is a certain group of people in every community that cannot do what we expect them to do unless they have a faith component. Unless they have that. Others will show us that they can meet the expectations of a community and live as good citizens without that outward apparent faith component. But because everyone cannot do that, and the data confirms it, Minnesota Teen Challenge has a 73% plus success rate at the same time with most of their students coming through our systems repeatedly, time and time again, sometimes 6, 7, and 8 times, and then they find success.
Thank you, Representative Olson. Representative Biskins, your closing remarks. Representative Biskins.
Thank you.
I believe you had a response.
Madam Chair, I did not.
Okay. Representative Carlson, very quickly.
All in the interest of time, you'll represent Dorn.
Representative
Dorn. Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, I misspoke and he heard it, and I want to clarify all the Dorns went to private school, Pete's and Paul's and Lyle, except for the one brother that
right.
Places, I hope.
Yeah, that's what we thought you were trying to say.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Viscus renews his motion that House File 3504 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on K-12 Finance. The clerk will take the roll.
Viscus?
Yes.
Erickson?
Yes.
Abler?
No.
Carlson?
No.
Sharon?
Aye.
Seibert?
Yes.
Dabney?
No.
Dean?
Yes.
Demmer?
Yes.
Dietrich?
No.
Dorn?
No.
Eastland?
Yes.
Eakin?
No.
Greiling?
No.
Heidkirchen?
No.
Clinton?
Yes.
Lanning?
Yes.
Latz?
No.
Mariani. Markworth.
No.
Nornis.
Yes.
Olson.
Yes.
Kowalski.
No.
Peterson.
No.
Rood.
No.
Saylor.
No.
Severson.
Yes.
Sikora.
Yes.
Wardlow.
No.
Thank you.
There being 13 ayes and 15 nays, the bill is not adopted. The bill is not passed. Members, we meet tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. In this room, Representative Biskins?
300 South.
In 300 South. We have several bills on the agenda. Please be on time. And Representative Sephora?
Chair, could I just ask how long you expect us to be here tomorrow?
Representative Biskins, how long tomorrow?
Madam Chair and members, number of hours. We have a few bills.
Number of hours. So all morning, I would say, Representative Sequoia.
Well, I'm assuming all morning. I'm wondering about the afternoon.
I don't think beyond the morning. 9 to 12. No?
No.
No, not that long. No longer. Okay. Well, we're moving to 200 after the lunch break. This meeting is adjourned.